Hello and welcome to Love is the Message, a podcast about music, the dance floor, counterculture and sound systems. I'm Jeremy Gilbert. I'm here as ever with my friend Tim Lawrence. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Jem.
And I think this is the conclusion of our micro sequence, our four episode micro sequence on what we're calling the emergence of a white gay dance scene in New York in the early 70s. And we are finally going to talk about the nightclub, which arguably was the iconic focal point for that emergence. And that is, well, Tim, tell us what it is.
It is the 10th floor. Maybe I should have tried to introduce that in a more dramatic way. But yeah, the 10th floor. It's interesting on some sort of level because there are all, as we have discussed to a certain extent, there is, you know, a heavy association with kind of gay male dancers and the very rise of DJ culture in the first place. And there's often an assumption that therefore the culture in its infancy was definitely male and gay, almost, you know, sometimes this is thought of as being kind of exclusive or you know, either white gay or black gay. And of course, the queer constituency within, you know, these early dance parties that we've been talking about over, you know, the last year or two was very important, but none of these venues were really what we might like, what we really should probably call gay venues, because they were always mixed to a certain extent. To sort of very briefly summarize what we've been saying in the last few episodes as well, there was, you know, gradually there were campaigns around rights, of course, and we kind of concluded that in the last episode when we noted the decriminalization of kind of, you know, of homosexuality within New York City towards the end of 1971, I think November 1971. But also in the summer of 1970, a kind of basically a white gay discotheque scene did take root in Fire Island. But it didn't take root in New York City in a very specific way until November 1972. Sorry, December 1972, the 6th of December 1972, which is when the 10th floor opened. To give a little bit of an overview of what that party was about, it was opened by three guys called David Brewey, Jim Jessup, and David Sokolov. And they were Fire Island regulars. They were considered to be part of one of the elite groups on Fire Island that would hang out at the Fire Island Pines, which was where the wealthier end of the Fire Island kind of residents would congregate. They spent the summer of 1972 together, and they subsequently kind of returned to Manhattan at the end of the summer, because a lot of places in New York would also close for the summer when people would go away. Not everywhere, of course, including places that catered for people who couldn't afford to go away on holiday. But anyway, parts of Manhattan were closed down. But at the end of the summer, David Brewey, Jim Jessup, and David Sokolov regrouped with their friends at the Continental Bars, which we spoke about in some detail in the last episode. And then they decided to open their own venue. And it was Jim Jessup who was really the key figure here. And he was a regular at this party that was called The Loft, which was opened by a guy called David Mancuso in February 1970, which we've talked about quite a lot. So this is the first time, really, that someone kind of goes to The Loft and comes away from The Loft deciding, I want to open a loft-style venue, but with a bit of a twist. So Jim Jessup kind of went up to David and said he and his friends wanted to open a loft-style party that would be strictly gay and white. This is what they told David. They wanted this sort of privacy. They wanted it to be discreet. And they told David they would only proceed if he said it was okay. And David, as he told me, turned back round to them and said, please go right ahead. And he said, I gave them all the help I could. It was like a good, I always like this quote, it was like a good joint, you passed it. I said we were like bees and could pollinate.
And did they really say to David they wanted it to be white?
Yes.
They were.
Well, this, okay, I don't know, because I'm to be honest, I don't think any of these three guys were still alive at the time I was writing Love Saves the Day. I'm pretty sure they weren't, and if they were, I would have been kind of told about it, because I was speaking to Richard Brett. I mean, I had a few people telling me about the 10th floor. One of them was Richard Bresner, who was best friends with, I forget if it was David Brewey, Jim Jessup, or David Sokolov, but he was very kind of intimate to what was going on. But so this is what David told me. They wanted it to be white and gay. It wouldn't particularly surprise me on some level, because, you know, they might have gone up to David thinking, well, David, you know, is not exactly going to give it his blessing if he feels it's like a competitor party. Nikki Ciano didn't go up to David and say, do you mind if I open the gallery? It's going to basically be trying to do everything that you do and take your crowd from you. So they probably thought it was kind of appropriate to say that the crowd was going to be very different. And they clearly wanted it to be a white gay crowd. It was for them and their mates from Fire Island and the Continental Baths, but in particular Fire Island. So, yeah, I don't know. I can't verify it, but that's what David told me. So, yeah, and so David's line, well, you know, so there's this quote, it's like a good joint, you pass it, we're like bees, we can pollinate, all these metaphors that are I quite like. It's a kind of post, you know, post, I don't really even know about this actually, but it's along the lines of, you know, we're not going to try and like have global revolution kind of overnight. But instead, we're just going to kind of change what we do in our front living room, get a bit of progressiveness in our front living room. And then hopefully, through a process of osmosis, the world will change. We're like bees and we can pollinate. Anyway, David also said it was all leading to a common goal. We didn't try to define it because it would have become like an organized religion. It was just a feeling. So the 10th floor was located in an old sewing machine factory on the 25th Street by 5th Avenue. It opened on a Wednesday night, first of all, although I think I'm pretty sure it then switched to a weekend night. Had a very minimalist aesthetic. A few hundred people went to the first party. There wasn't a special sound system particularly. It was 6 Bose speakers. Yeah, it was like a group of people who wanted to have a party, but they weren't like really trying to develop kind of a venue, I suppose, in the same way that David was, at least at this point. And the DJ is an interesting figure called Ray Yates, who was a mixed race DJ. And I think it would be nice to hear a couple of the records he would play. I mean, I do know that he was into the Staple Singers, I'll Take You There, and the Equals, Black Skinned, Blue Eyed Boys, but I think we've played both of those. So let's have a listen to a couple of other records just quickly that Ray Yates would play. And one is Area Code's Stone Fox Chase. We may as well have a listen to another record, I think, because it'd be nice to hear a little bit of music, get some as much music in as we can. And this is so another Ray Yates record that became sort of popular at the 10th floor was Glass House, I Can't Be You, (You Can't Be Me).
Yeah, interesting lyric there. I can't be you, you can't be me. I think the emergent gay scene at this time, as much as any other emergent culture or subculture or counterculture or liberation movement, it exhibits this perpetual tension between appeals to some expanded and utopian idea of community on the one hand, and on the other hand, appeals to essentially a sort of a classical liberal individualism. And like, I can't be you, you can't be me is Seems on the face of it, at least, to be a pretty standard statement of liberal individualism, like asserting the non-relationality of the individuals involved.
Yes, I think that's a very persuasive point. And yeah, you're right. It doesn't. You can't. You know, the whole point of the Dancer is that it actually does. We realise that we can be each on some level. We can be each other, if not that, then we're inherently. Everything is connected.
Well, it's true. And also, and I guess that tension sort of plays out a little bit as well in the role that the gay dance floor, the queer dance floor ends up playing over the next few decades, actually. You know, just in my direct experience, actually, going back to the early 90s, on the one hand, the queer dance floor could be the site of absolute sort of ecstatic communality, like par excellence. But of course, also the fact that the queer dance floor is coded as queer rather than sort of asexual or non-sexual, or it does have a sort of you know, it also sets it up as being a space at which, you know, it, you know, individualized couples are going to, you know, interact with each other and find sort of sexual partnerships. And that tension, there's an interesting tension that's always there. I think in the loft, like the role, the status of sort of sexual coupling, or the party as a site for sexual coupling, is sort of an interesting one, because obviously people did meet partners there, but there's always been this sense that in a way it was never its primary purpose. And there remains a sort of a way of experiencing club culture and the dance floor, according to which, you know, somehow that's a purpose for the dance floor, which is a bit vulgar. It's beneath the spiritual purity of the sort of communal ecstasy that some of us are seeking. And I'm not actually proposing a sort of a value judgment or a hierarchy of values here. I just think there's an interesting set of, there's a different interesting set of paradoxes that get played out sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting point to raise. I think it changes over time and in settings. I mean, I think we're going to come on, you know, a little bit later in the show to talk about, to spoil any possible surprise there might have been. And it wasn't going to be such a big surprise, probably, as we're going to also talk about Flamingo and 12 West. And certainly by the time we get to Flamingo, so I think we should return to this probably, I would say you do get a real tribal aesthetic. And there is a beginning of the disappearance of the individual. And that becomes an active aspiration. And sex is something that, well, I think in the 10th floor, and we're going to get onto this in just a second. Also, because it's a kind of a specifically male gay scene, or like, well, what's the opportunity here for me to meet someone? And there are these obvious parallels as well between historic cruising culture and then what can happen on the dance floor, yes, which is almost sure, like a definitional cruising space if it becomes a space where people are gathering because they have a similar sexual proclivity, i.e. they like men. At the loft, I mean, yeah, this is the whole point about the loft on some level, you're right, is that it broke with the idea that you went out dancing in order to meet with someone of the opposite sex. The loft was all about you went out dancing because you're in love with music and, you know, maybe getting high in a particular way and being in a community that is very open. And yeah, of course people would meet at the loft, but I don't think people went there with that intention, and it wasn't something that would actually be a factor during the course of the evening, seeing people kind of hitting it off, let's say. I'd say there's definitely more of that in the 10th floor, there's no question. By the time you get to Flamingo, it sort of probably shifts a little bit. And while there's a kind of sexual frisson in the air, it's pretty certainly the case that no one actually bothers to do anything about it until the end of the night, which is when they would head to the Continental Baths. I mean, there is a parallel kind of basically SM scene going on with places like the Anvil. They're not so much like regular kind of dance parties, if you like, because there's a lot of sex going on. So there is that parallel scene. And then you get, you know, the other big jump in all of this is when the Saint opens in the autumn of 1980, and that has a balcony where men basically can go and have sex. And that becomes a kind of, as far as I'm aware, almost for the first time in, you know, Manhattan outside of the actual places like the Anvil, it's the first time where you can go out to a dance place and be on the active lookout or go somewhere where you'll have sex. Otherwise, the general experience seems to be like, we go out, we have a serious ecstatic dance experience of some sort, and then at the end of the night, we might look for someone to kind of go home with. But I'm sure there's a lot of variety within that.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So just to sort of wrap up a little bit about, because we, you know, you made that interesting point about I can't be you and you can't be me. So of Ray Yates, he was this guy called Bob Casey, who was actually quite an influential sound engineer in the early 70s and did install quite a lot of important sound systems, including at the Continental Baths. He said of Ray Yates that he was one of the first DJs to go techno, which obviously sounds a bit bizarre in some ways, given that techno music kind of came through in Detroit in maybe 1986, 87. But it was more that I think he's obviously talking about someone who was interested in quite abstract music. Bob Casey said he was like, it's quite into avant-garde, spaced out music. And, you know, we didn't really mention the really big track, which we have also played before on the show at least once earlier on, was Patty Joe's Make Me Believe in You. And if you think about it, that is a very kind of spaced out, kind of mesmeric track. So, you know, early techno, Patty Joe, there's somehow a kind of electrical feel to it with the production. I'm not sure I quite know how to describe it, but I can see what's being said anyway.
It's that sort of haunting quality which infuses kind of the earliest Detroit techno tracks.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And the other thing is that it's very stripped down and spaced out. I mean, it's spatialized, you know, it's very raw and minimalistic, that track. And that was the big record at this venue. So you can sort of see how there was, and we all know how listening to this kind of more abstract, stripped down kind of music could really take you into a different place. He's not talked about very much, Ray Yates. I want to throw in one other comment, which is from this guy, Richard Bresner, who was best mates with one of these founding guys, David Brewery, Jim Jessup, David Sokolov. And Richard Bresner said of Ray Yates, he played music that no one else played. But this is what interested me more, perhaps, is that he used this feature called sound on sound. He would take the record he was playing to one channel and bring in the next record on the other channel. Then he would flip a switch and the new record would be playing through both channels. He says it was a very primitive way of mixing, but it worked at the time.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I don't really have anything to add, but it is really interesting.
Maybe, is it something you think you might try at Beauty and the Beat?
No, probably not.
Okay, well, in that case, we won't discuss it anymore.
I'm very much I'm a fade in, fade out person.
Love is the message.
The main thing to say about the 10th floor, I think, other than what's been said before already, maybe, is that it was sort of a real social phenomenon in its own way. You know, there was definitely, I would say, or I was told, you know, and therefore I will repeat, that there was more focusing on the socializing than the dancing. It was the sense of like the fascination of being in the room with all these kind of similar kind of gay white guys, I guess, at the same time, which hadn't quite happened in the same way before. The place wasn't set enough up, you know, with enough intention to have it as a kind of, you know, absolutely immersive dance experience. So the social side was very important. A kind of this sort of a new fashion, at least again, this is what I've been told by participants, did sort of kind of come through at the 10th floor. It was like an unofficial uniform, if you like, that did become identified with the gay white scene for a while and beyond. And it involves items that sound so basic to us that it's kind of hard to believe that this was a kind of a new way of bringing these elements together in this particular moment. But it involved Levi's jeans, construction boots, a hooded zippered sweatshirt, and a waist-length flight jacket. In this case, there was silver on the outside and orange on the inside. And the hood of the sweatshirt would be flipped outside of the jacket. One of the kind of idiosyncrasies of this is that it was a neighbor of the 10th floor made the flight jackets. And so initially the owners and staff were wearing them, but then it became kind of a, you know, something that everyone wanted to do. And then apparently Bloomingdale's started to sell them a year later. And this is something that does emerge, you know, it's like the kind of the prominence of this constituency within the kind of fashion and art and theatrical, et cetera, world, design worlds is, you know, something that I heard about quite a lot.
What about this fairly notorious, you know, exclusivity which the 10th floor came to be associated with?
Exactly. I mean, this is another aspect of the politics of this invite system that they borrowed from David. What they wanted to be able to do is not be restricted by New York City's cabaret licensing laws. This is kind of one of the relatively simple things that underpins the idea of the loft. It's not the thing that we think about first normally. We might think about balloons or Clipshawns or David and all the rest of it, integrating different sounds, blah, blah, et cetera. But, you know, really the very fundamental principles of David's effort was to be able to have privacy, to not sell alcohol, to not have the state interfere with what you want to do beyond maybe guaranteeing that the fire exits are in place, and to be able to carry on, you know, dancing all night, basically. So you wouldn't have to close according to New York cabaret licensing regulations. But it's the invite list that enabled David to do this. It's the invite list that the 10th floor picked up. And it's the invite list that enabled them to, you know, develop a, you know, everyone who runs these invite lists creates a certain crowd. David's approach to the invite list was, well, anyone can really join if you're recommended by a friend. And David had a mixed group of friends, and he had ended up having a very mixed kind of, you know, group of people come to his party. But this invite list was used, deployed in a different way. And it became this way that it became a very kind of homogeneous group who were, I mean, I think almost entirely exclusively white and gay, if not middle class economically and financially, then middle class in terms of perhaps, you know, culturally. So it became known internally, this group started to call themselves the 500. These were supposed to be the most advanced, intelligent, attractive, witty, charming 500 people in Manhattan, or certainly 500 people within this kind of gay scene. But I think there was a sort of, you know, it was, they understood themselves to be a kind of, you know, an elite group, if you like, and would, and took a great deal of pride in this. And they understood that they came from the Pines rather than Cherry Grove, which was kind of a bit more, you know, was less so. So, yeah, so that's what's going on. And it does generate this kind of this mythology, which, of course, gets to be also reflected in this, you know, the Andrew Holleran novel, Dancer from the Dance, which also kind of draws, you know, and, you know, also explores some of the tensions within this, because it can, you know, it can put an awful lot of pressure on someone to live up to this kind of this ideal that you got to be, you know,
yes,
perfectly toned in the gym, and you got to be well read, and you got to have gone to the opera early in the week, and, you know, if, you know, a fine cook gathering fresh herbs and whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Holleran novel is really fascinating. We've mentioned it a couple of times before, I think, in passing. Andrew Holleran is the pen name of Eric Garber, who's a writer born in 1944, but still alive, I think. But I think it's one he's stuck with because I think fairly unexpectedly, his first novel, Dancer from the Dance, which is a pretty explicit novel about gay life in New York at a time, and that would still be shocking to many audiences, was a huge literary sensation. It was a national bestseller, and it really made his reputation. And it is a great book. It's very easy to read. It's very, you know, it's very easy to read, very beautifully, sort of delicately written. You can sort of see, if you know the work of Armistead Maupin, you know, Maupin, I think, sort of starts off like sort of, he's like a sort of Andrew Holleran, but with slightly less high-flown literary ambitions. But it's that sort of very readable depiction of a sort of queer urban counterculture, very engaging. But I guess also, you know, famously, as you said, Tim, I mean, the book is a bit of a Bildungsroman. It's a bit of a sort of coming of age novel. The story is basically about, you know, it focuses on the lives of a small group of gay men whose social lives for the central period of the novel revolve around the 10th floor. I can't remember what it's called in the. I don't think he names it as the 10th floor, but yeah, it depicts this world, which is a world which sort of couldn't really have existed or anything like as publicly, even 10 years previously, in which indeed you basically have this highly privileged group of mostly affluent, young, white, gay men, within which there is, you know, a very intensive competitive hierarchy to have like the best body and the best boyfriend and the most sex, and also some more conventional markers of social status. And the book doesn't really make explicit a political critique. It's more a sort of existential critique. I mean, at the end of the book, at least one of the characters, the main focalizing character, has become quite disillusioned with what seems to be the shallowness and vapidity of this scene. And of course, this comes out in 78. It's written mostly in 77, so it's pretty quick. I mean, you've gone pretty quickly from the scene emerging to being memorialized in a classic of late 20th century American literature, and to being memorialized partly on the basis of its, you know, vacuity and superficiality, even from the point of view of someone who was heavily involved in it. You know, and I guess that has sort of coloured, I mean, it colours one's assumptions about that scene when looking back on it historically as well, actually, because that is sort of the theme of the book. I mean, the sense one gets from the book is of a sort of a particular form of very, very elite gay male culture really being transposed from the world of what would have been called in America prep schools, you know, public schools in Britain, into this slightly more public context of a club culture, emergent club culture in downtown New York, you know, with all of the implications of snobbery and competitiveness and sort of possessiveness that entails. But it's often read as this quite melancholic book and as this sort of classic text which reflects on the one hand, I mean, I'm talking about all the negative elements because that's sort of how it ends. I mean, much of the book is just this very exciting, you know, depiction of the extraordinary freedom and the extraordinary erotic satisfaction available to the people living in this scene. You know, these people are just sort of living this thoroughly eroticized life where they can have lots of sex with lots of partners who are all gorgeous and having a fabulous time. But the book also reflects on the extent to which, well, even within that scene, like only a few people who've got lots of money can really fully enjoy it, and other people are having to sort of use their sexuality to try to extract resources from those people. And it ends up with a reflection on the fact that, well, in that sort of a scene, it's quite difficult for people to find things that people of all sexual orientations have historically often wanted from sexual relationships, like lasting commitment, meaningful intimacy, etc. And it ends up with the sort of idea that you can't really find those things on the dance floor of the 10th floor, at least, that you have to go somewhere else if that's what you're going to look for. It's a really fascinating meditation, and I think I read it years and years ago. For me, it sort of reminded me also of reading Trainspotting. In the same way that Trainspotting is a book about junkies, he's a heroin addict in Edinburgh in the late 80s, but the audience for Trainspotting becomes, its great historic audience is like ravers.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy,
ravers in the mid-90s. And my theory about that was always because, well, Trainspotting, it poses a set of questions which might have been very immediate for smackheads in Edinburgh in the late 80s, but which then becomes sort of the existential question posed for an entire cohort, like sort of my cohort of ravers, which is, well, you know, given how messed up, you know, society has become, and then the fact that we don't seem to be able to influence the direction in which it's going, should we just accept, you know, whatever forms of, you know, hedonistic escapism become available to us, rather than wasting our time trying to engage, or rather than choosing life, as the monologue that ends up opening the film version says. And Dancer from the Dance does sort of poses a question which ends up being quite relevant to lots of cohorts of people in different social and cultural situations over the next few decades, which is, well, given that the countercultural utopia which the Loft sort of tried to embody wasn't going to materialize on any bigger scale, you know, is it better just to accept what late capitalism offers us, which is the chance at least for a few years to be, you know, to be hot, to be free, and to do a lot of fucking? And I sort of think that is still, I think that's the dilemma which a lot of young people today sort of find themselves with, actually. You know, do you just accept that for a few years you can be hot on Instagram and on dating apps and just get a lot of sex, and, you know, that's what your life's going to be about? Or do you look for something else? Do you recoil immediately from the ephemerality of that? So I think it has a real resonance, I think, still, the novel, which I think is really interesting.
Interesting to draw that parallel with Trainspotting. You took me by surprise there.
I took myself
by
surprise.
I didn't know we were allowed to actually say things that we hadn't pre... I'm joking, right? I think that, like, we've got to be careful not to kind of get too distracted, but it's a really interesting point that you're raising there. And I would just say with Trainspotting, it's, yeah, I was always struck by, I think it's about the energy of the writing and it's about the general subject matter. So it's just about, you know, young people taking drugs and living on the edge of society. I mean, I guess the ending is he's kind of going to kind of get everything sorted out, isn't he? And kind of straighten up.
Yeah, yeah.
I think with the 10th floor, there is my memory of it, again, having read it years and years ago, is that it's the ambivalence is there from maybe, you know, early on. I don't particularly remember it being a conclusion, although I could be wrong and I'm not even entirely sure you were saying that. But I think there's always the ambivalence. And I think that's part of the entire framing of that scene at the time. On the one hand, it's celebratory for all the reasons we've already discussed in previous episodes. But at the same time, there's still a legacy of living, you know, closeted lives or being, you know, framed by the law as being kind of, you know, illegal. You know, there's this identification with the black female diva, which is, again, something we've mentioned in probably a much earlier episode. And it's that kind of, it's a sense of, you know, emotional strength, you know, despite, you know, social and, you know, emotional hardship. It's like, how do you navigate this? Yes. And there's always a melancholy built in there, I suppose, is what I'm saying. There's a sense of, you know, that true love may not be lasting. And I think you're right. I think that's a very prominent part of the 10th floor. I mean, it's just, you know, as with these things, I think it's obviously important to remember that these are representations. Also the 10th floor was, it was the 10th floor. Also Dancer from the Dance was supposed to be a reflection of this venue 12 West, which we'll talk about very soon, as well as the 10th floor. But yeah, it's a representation. There's the side of gay culture. And also we could just say late capitalist culture, which is about kind of pleasure and focusing on pleasure through sex or music or dance, whatever it might be, going shopping. And then there's, you know, the stepping back from that, in which you sort of say, well, how are we going to kind of, you know, change, you know, also change the world? And I think, Andrew Holleran became one of a number of emerging voices around this time within the gay community that were, you know, and Larry Kramer actually, you know, famously became another, who was kind of, you know, becoming quite critical of what was perceived to be kind of, let's put this in inverted commas, excessive hedonism of the gay scene, and saying, actually, this is not bringing us kind of permanent happiness. So I think Dancer from the Dance kind of was one of a number of articulations of this position that has become, you know, would go on to become increasingly prominent with, you know, with queer writers being quite critical of, let's say, the consumerism of gay culture. But we should also remember that we're at the very beginning of that story here.
That's what really always fascinates me about the most radical thinkers in this moment, both as sort of theorists and philosophers and writers like Holleran, is they can see right from the start that the normalization of gay culture might happen in a particular way, and it's a particular way that's fully incorporated into a form of consumer capitalism that's only really just starting to take shape at all. So it's very impressive, really. It's impressive, like, how acutely aware they are of that sort of leading edge of emergent phenomena.
Yeah. I mean, this is obviously like this part of a lifestyle culture, isn't it? We can't just call it consumer culture because they're not really buying anything. And certainly we've talked about the Levi's jeans and the construction boots and the zippered sweatshirt kind of thing, which is like, I mean, all of this is part of the emergence of a kind of, you know, post-Fordist economy where more emphasis goes on kind of leisure time and what you do with yourself in that leisure time and how you begin to express and, you know, for want of a better term, identity within through that leisure time. And you can do it through shopping. And in fact, it's probably, you know, it's more impressive to be doing it through going to out dancing than to do it through shopping. And the 10th floor is part of that. It's like, there's the question of like, well, how do we form new forms of social organization that are meaningful?
Yeah, you're right.
Dancer from the Dance looks at some of the limitations of that, the sense of, you know, the sense of emptiness you can potentially feel at the end of a night. And interestingly, the owners soon became pretty fed up with running the 10th floor because they felt it got out of control and they didn't like their own party because it just became this nightmare of sort of managing the door, people trying to get too many, you know, you're on the invite list, but you bring too many guests unannounced. The place gets crowded. Regular guests can't get in. People are on the invite list, can't get in. So it became this sort of, you know, this social phenomenon that became a little bit of a nightmare. I do quickly want to touch on this kind of question of race, though. But a very good friend, a very close friend of Larry Levan's called Nathan Bush, did go to the 10th floor, and he was, I mean, just, you know, he said it was obvious you weren't welcome. He felt very uneasy. And, you know, there was all this, there was, you know, there were sort of, you know, social codes were being kind of articulated that weren't necessarily very explicit, but were implicit about whether you were or you weren't welcome, or, you know, to what extent was there, you know, sensitivity to racial difference, for example, in these environments. And I think there's clearly an issue there. I mean, people of color who went into this situation felt very uncomfortable. I mean, Richard Bresner, this guy who I did interview quite extensively on this particular party, who was friends with one of the owners, he would sort of say, well, Ray Yates was black, the DJ was black. David Sokolov, who was this Richard Bresner's mate, I think, it was like, you know, certainly didn't care about the color of anyone's skin. He says another one of the owners only liked black boys. I mean, I think there was this emerge this kind of, you know, this phenomenon of, you know, white gay men sometimes wanting kind of younger, you know, bringing into this situation. And this was definitely a pattern, you know, very young men of color, as they're kind of, you know, as someone who they're going to have a bit of fun with that night or at the end of the night. So there's a lot of the kind of, you know, people of color, dancers of color who are in this environment were there as you know, as an appendage of, you know, someone else who was kind of held the power, if you like. So there's from within the party, there was a kind of feeling like, well, we weren't, you know, we certainly didn't want to exclude anyone. And, you know, black people would have been welcome. And, you know, there wasn't any overt racism, but black people, if they did go there, Puerto Rican, didn't feel comfortable. This does become an emerging tension, if you like, within the gay scene, the extent to which, you know, white gay dancers and black gay dancers are able to share a dance floor. And it does actually become pretty divided pretty quickly. Anyway, I mean, so Alan Harris, who is the future owner of this venue, 12 West, which we'll talk about soon, he also was a regular at the Loft, and he did go to the 10th floor. And it's kind of, you know, I mean, it's what he says might be come across as being a little bit predictable but at this point in the conversation, but I'll mention it anyway because I think he puts it quite well. So he says, I went to the 10th floor, he told me. I went to the 10th floor and I went to the Loft, and there was a big difference between the two. There was no attitude at the Loft. David was a really nice man. He played the type of music I liked, and he had a very crossover crowd. The Loft was, let's embrace everybody who can get in. The 10th floor, on the other hand, was much more attitudinal. It was about who's in and who's out. And he carries on. The Loft was about dancing, whereas the 10th floor was about dancing and getting laid. At the David's, the group was too diverse for that. You would dance with a 300-pound black lady and have the most fabulous time. That wouldn't happen at the 10th floor. They would screen that person out at the door. The Loft was warm and loving, whereas the 10th floor was more sensual and sexual. There was definitely a feeling of let's go out and get laid, and the 10th floor met that demand. It was certainly needed at the time. I guess this is a reasonable point. It was needed, you know, there was people went there because they wanted to. So, and David was invited to go along, and he said, I went to the parties once or twice. I'm quoting, they were okay, but it wasn't my scene. They only took a part of the party. It was a white male gay thing. He said, I'd seen spaces like that before, only they weren't in Loft spaces or organised around cards, but I had my own parties to be getting on with.
Well, that's really interesting. I think we should have a bit of music, because I wanted to play this Zulima track, because in Dancer from the Dance, the track that gets mentioned as the anthem of this imagined composite nightclub is this track by Zulima, Giving Up, which I sort of know as a track from playlists from the gallery from that time, and which I'm really fond of. I got it. I hadn't heard of it before I got the book, and I played it lots of times when DJing. It's a sort of classic, sort of operatic, sort of melodramatic bit of diva disco. And Zulima was, it's a black female singer, and it is really interesting that it's music by black women that becomes central in this white gay scene. And, you know, we can understand why in ways that Tim's talked about. We can also see why other critics more recently have seen this as somewhat problematic in some ways. There wasn't really sort of explicitly white male gay music to draw on. And one thing I'm sure we'll look at over the next covering the next sort of decade and a half of dance music from this point on, is that does eventually emerge.
Why is it problematic? Why do you say it's,
well, because some people have seen it as sort of appropriative, that you have these essentially very privileged men who, you know, sort of adopting and making use of a sonic technology which really has its roots in the Black Church. I mean, I'm not...
Yeah,
I'm
but they're not, ma- they're not going... They're not no, in,
I'm
I don't
not
know.
Making that
yeah, yeah.
argument.
Okay, all right.
Other
okay.
people have.
Okay.
Other people have, you know, in articles, in academic journal articles, slagging you off. So, you know...
what?
I'm not...
You are making this up, Jem.
I have
per
not,
usual.
I have not... I
can't
have not
believe
made
you
this
come
argument.
Up with shit like this, I, then, that anyone would ever criticise me.
I have argued.
I quit.
Those arguments are, in my opinion, misplaced for reasons which should be clear, but to anyone listening, but they've been made. And, you know, I guess you can sort of see more, you can see where those people are coming from more when you think about the social democratic of the 10th floor than if you apply it to something like the loft. And,
well, I don't really agree, but that's fine, isn't it? I like the, but I have more, I personally have more of an issue if, you know, this, I've written an article about this. We'll come back to it probably in like 4 or 5 series time, because we've got quite a lot that we want to get through before we get to 1980. But, you know, it was at the Saint that opened in 1980 that, you know, for the first time within what we are calling this white gay scene or the white gay, you know, they basically, you, after a year or two, and it still did take a year or two, you almost stopped hearing Black music, recording by band.
Yeah.
That is far more problematic to me in what is almost an entirely white gay environment.
Yeah, of course. I agree with that.
Okay. Well, that's
I agree. Why. And I'm also sort of slightly, as you know, I'm fascinated in a way that you're not with that sort of white aesthetic, that white electronic funkless, deliberately funkless aesthetic that emerges from the Saint and ends up becoming the soundtrack to sort of the most self-consciously psychedelic sort of dance scene of our era. Like it's go, you know, that's where sort of psytrance has its roots, in the moment when gay discos stop playing Black Diva music and start playing something else instead. It's a really weird history, which literally no one to date has properly covered or talked about. So
anyway,
but indeed.
Oh, I'll just say one more thing. I also just think that, you know, they're just playing. I mean, I am laboring the point. I don't want to labor the point, but it's like they're just playing the record and they're enjoying it. It's not they're covering it, but getting a white, I don't know, or making money out of it or anything.
No, that's true. Like, and I love the record. I love Zulema giving up. It's really, it's an absolute classic of that melodramatic diva disco. Giving up. Hard to do with you. Really love someone. Giving up. Hard to do with you. See, depend upon his warm and tender touch. His kiss and his... I mean, segueing maybe a little bit radically away from this, but, and I can't remember if we talked about Leo Bassani and his kind of famous essay is The Wrexham, A Grave, which was obviously published during the height of the AIDS pandemic and was a reference to that. And it's kind of interesting partly because it refutes this kind of desire that was emerging during the height of the AIDS crisis to view this pre-AIDS gay scene as idyllic. And often people might think of the 10th floor and maybe Flamingo, as we're going to come on to talk about, and 12 West as being idyllic. And what Bassani, one of the many things Bassani argues in this essay is that that the economy, you know, what he calls the economies of desire, are ingrained in social orders where many people are excluded. And he doesn't talk about the 10th floor specifically, but I thought it was really interesting that he should sort of say that, yes, you know, there are these early early queer formations, if you like, that's understood for understandable reasons to be idyllic. But there are, you know, there are exclusions in this scene, and the 10th floor does become a kind of an example of that. Yeah, good point. Really good point.
Without music, life would be a mistake.
So the Flamingo was opened by a guy called Michael Fesco. We've talked about it before. It was Michael Fesco who had opened the Ice Palace in Cherry Grove on Fire Island in the summer of 1970. So it was a very early part.
And the Flamingo is where exactly?
Well, the Flamingo is in downtown New York. It's around the corner from where the gallery will reopen, which is on 599 Broadway. This is Lower Broadway on the corner of Houston Street.
And when does it open?
So opened in December 1974.
Okay. So it's a couple of years on from the 10th floor.
Yeah, exactly. And what had happened is that Michael Fesco, you know, had a few very successful seasons with the Ice Palace on Fire Island. The summer of 1973, I'm pretty sure it was much more difficult. I think there was a fire. There was more competition from his rival.
There was a fire on Fire Island.
Exactly.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. So maybe because of the name of the island, it didn't make the headlines, but apparently it was a bad fire. So in the summer of 1974, Michael Fesco started a search for spaces to open a place in Manhattan. Michael Fesco went to the 10th floor. I should probably say one of my favorite photos in the whole of Love Saves the Day is Michael Fesco dressed up in kind of, you know, something that's approximating SM leather regalia, taken, I'm pretty sure, of the summer of 1970. On Fire Island. And it's a very beautiful photo. And Michael was an incredibly charming and sweet guy who I very much enjoyed interviewing. He passed away, I think it might have been 2 years ago at this point. There was a good obit appeared in the New York Times. And of course, I write about Michael's work. I do write about it extensively in Love Saves the Day. And he's one of the scene's unsung heroes, if you like. I mean, he did become in this part a key figure within this part of the scene that we don't kind of haven't been immersed in ourselves, but I always want to sort of pay tribute to him. Apart from anything else, as just being a really, you know, a pioneer, but also like someone who was genuinely very, you know, a really lovely guy. And it was Michael who came back and started he went to the 10th floor and he said that it gave me the idea to do a private club in a loft space. So it was kind of to replicate it, but to kind of expand it really. Because, you know, apart from anything else, the 10th floor had all these problems of trying to get people in really. It was too small. Michael Fesco opened the Flamingo on the corner of Houston Street and Broadway in December of 1974. And by the time he moved to do this, basically the 10th floor had closed without even announcing it was closing. And effectively, the owners of the 10th floor came back to Manhattan after the summer of 1974 and just decided they didn't want to carry on anymore. They, you know, they had kind of fallen out with their own party. Flamingo opened. Vince Aletti gave it a nice review of the opening night in Record World. I always think it's kind of nice to track what Vince is writing about these venues through his reports. He just says, wonderfully hectic. An anthem that emerges, just to bring in a bit of music, an anthem that does emerge at, you know, maybe the anthem that emerges at Flamingo is South Shore Commission's Free Man. We have played that before. So instead, I'll play another record that I know Amanda Galvez would play. He selected it in one of his charts that appeared in Vince Aletti's Disco Files columns in one of the DJ lists. It was also a kind of a gay anthem as such because of its kind of innuendo in the title. And the title is That's Where the Happy People Go. And it's by the Temptations. And the happy people are supposedly gay men, largely. So this is the Temptations record from 1975 that's beginning to acknowledge the emergence of basically, you know, gay men kind of, you know, going out to kind of discotheques and private parties. So let's have a listen to that track. So, I mean, I really like the Temptations, actually. They're a fantastic band.
Yeah, they are a great really, band. They're one of really, the great bands.
Yeah, Law of the Land was another big record, but there's lots of really good Temptations records. I mean, it's like Norman Whitfield is just a genius, really.
So what about 12 West then?
Yeah, well, you want to keep moving on to 12 West, don't you? But I do want to say a bit more about Flamingo. Are you finding this boring or you just have a particular affinity? I know.
Haven't got loads of filler to cut. So.
Well, it's an, one thing to sort of say is it's an expanded version of the 10th floor. And, you know, it's the eight, what was referred to, what the crowd that would go to Flamingo would refer to themselves as the A-list. And this group, they call themselves the 500 at the 10th floor. It's just a refinement of a group where, as Michael Fesco put it to me, everyone was very beautiful. Gorgeous boys would go home with gorgeous boys. And it, you know, as Michael acknowledged, we were 99% gay and 99% white, but there was no conscious membership policy. Some people just happened to like the kind of music that we played, and others preferred the music that was being played at places like the Gallery. We attracted very distinct crowds. None of my friends knew the Nicky Siano crowd, and vice versa. So, and you know, Michael also added, you know, because I think it's an interesting point, sex was not the reason the boys went to Flamingo. Sex happened after leaving the club when great numbers would go to the St. Mark's Baths. A quick reference point, because I think it is actually historically significant, is that Michael Fesco and Flamingo were the first place to introduce, was the first place, at least within this party scene, to introduce these kind of theme nights. And he introduced the white party, the red party, and the black party. And the black party was a leather party. And it became a real phenomenon within this kind of, you know, the gay dance scene. You know, Robert Mapplethorpe did really interesting flyers for the you know, the black party at the Saint in, I can't remember if it was 1982 or 83. So that becomes a real phenomenon, and it goes back to Michael and Georges Latour, who was kind of very involved with this whole kind of, you know, the kind of male gay end of the dance scene, in particular the, you know, lover of Steve Ostro, who was running the Continental Baths. Georges Latour said Michael was very creative. Michael brought these more explicit practices, because at the black party you would basically see performance artists carrying out sexual acts, animals, tattooists, all sorts of things were going on, and these, you know, these kind, you know, they'd be in these, like, these display, I don't even know what to call them, you know, cabinet, or not cabinet, but kind of area that were cordoned off, like performance art, basically. And it was Georges Latour, you know, says Michael brought these more explicit practices out of the closet, and it liberated a lot of people. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Oh, that's really interesting.
I mean, it's a shame, we do sort of need to move on a bit, don't we? But there's a really interesting kind of DJing setup, kind of starts to, you know, be basically instituted at Flamingo, and a kind of good cop, bad cop, basically. Howard Merritt and Richie Rivera end up playing alternate Saturday nights. And eventually, even quite soon, the Flamingo starts to hold a tea party on Sunday afternoons. I think there's a film night might follow that, or maybe the film night is on the Monday, I forget. But it becomes, you know, there is open a few nights a week, really. But the main DJs are Howard Merritt and Richie Rivera. And I do want to talk at least a little bit about Richie Rivera, because he was David Rodriguez, alongside David Rodriguez, the significant kind of Puerto Rican DJ who did start DJing in 1971. And as we actually did mention, if not in the last episode, then the one before, he was DJing at the Firehouse when they, you know, which was the home of the Gay Liberation Front, when they started to hold kind of Saturday night dance parties. So that was Richie Rivera. And it's interesting, he was quite progressive. He wasn't, you know, he was kind of, you know, in the same line, if you like, as kind of Ray Yates. He played a lot of synthesized music, instrumental music, music that felt like it was moody and druggy. You know, these are kind of quotes of people who were kind of going and listening to him and trying to describe his style. He was a very accomplished mixer. And he was kind of, I think he became nicknamed Bongo Richie. I'd need to check my notes on this, but he would often play kind of music that featured, you know, Latin percussion, and became renowned for this. As far as I'm aware, he's the first DJ who became renowned for kind of playing, you know, music that would often be, you know, have a Latin element. I know you really like Standing Right Here by, is it Melba Moore? Am I getting this mixed up?
Yeah.
So this is one of Richie Rivera's most famous mixes. And there's a lot of percussion on there. It's really great percussive tracks, in case, so you may have been aware of that, maybe not. But this is that record came a little bit later.
Standing right here, sorry.
What did I say? Standing Right There?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Doesn't matter.
Embarrassing. Just to say, you know, more briefly, that Howard Merritt was, you know, a bearded country boy from the Catskills who went to Fire Island for the first time in the summer of 1973 and I think never went home after that. And he played kind of sweeter, prettier music, like Barry White's It's Ecstasy, When You Lay Down Next to Me. Oh, isn't that such a fantastic title? It's Ecstasy, When You Lay Down Next to Me. Almost want to say it again. Odyssey's Native New Yorker. you know, more sensed, you know, more sensitive type, if you like, sweeter music. And I think that's the kind of, you know, that's also, it's interesting that we have those two kind of, that have this pairing of the DJs. But the thing that I really want to say, I suppose, about Flamingo is, and I might just quote Georges Latour on this, because he really did kind of, you know, paint a very vivid picture of this for me when I was doing these interviews. And it was like, what it really clarifies, the way that, you know, a new type of dance experience emerged at Flamingo. And it was different from the Loft. But, it, you know, there was some replication, because unlike 10th Floor, dance really was the focal point. So I'm just going to read this Georges Latour quote, because I think it's good. The dance was the purpose. You would spend the whole night there. That was what brought people together, and it got really intense. The sexual energy in the place was just incredible, and it was exacerbated by the amount of drugs everybody was consuming. There was a kind of pure male testosterone-driven male bonding, and that was what Flamingo was all about. It was just very charged. It was really tribal, and it began to acquire a spiritual edge.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think it's like, and there's Georges Latour spoke at length about this with me, and we can't go into any more detail now. We may return to this as a theme in another episode. But yeah, it's like drugs, bodies, you know, men started to take their shirts off. A lot of the guys were working out in the gym. But it's like, it's, you know, they were taking lots of drugs, and they were having, you know, they were leaving their, you know, they were entering into a kind of sense of a tribal imaginary. Extra, you know, outside of their bodies, and that was, that became the purpose, to have that kind of, you know, this kind of, you know, spiritual kind of experience through this very charged, you know, environment. So the dancing at these places was not at all expressive. It was kind of almost the opposite of the Loft on some level. It was like you merge into a crowd, really. You just merge into a rhythm, and it's not about kind of expression, but it's about kind of, you know, immersion. And,
yes,
you
yes. Know,
and I think there's a, it's really fascinating, actually.
It is really fascinating.
And it's certainly, obviously, what, you know, that my early experience of rave was that, you know, that's what you were getting.
Yeah.
You know, the music was quite repetitive. You know, the crowd was not even necessarily that diverse. You know, that wasn't the point of it. It was just kind of like this kind of, just kind of, it was this idea, you dance hard enough, and if you've got enough kind of drugs in your body and the music is taking you there, you have this kind of big crowd experience.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. That's really interesting. And the sort of becoming spiritual of something that might start off as fairly sexual as well. Very interesting. Very, I mean, yeah, definitely gets repeated, especially in very sort of male-dominated rave spaces, whether even ones dominated most by men who mostly weren't gay, like in later decades. So can we finally
are you how
I don't know why I'm so interested in 12 words.
I was like, I don't know if I've even got much to say about it. I feel bad. No, I do have a bit, but I don't want to take too long, because we want to,
because I always remember it having the reputation for being less elitist, less exclusive.
Exactly, that's exactly what it was. So it was Alan Harris, the guy who had been to the Loft and loved the Loft and been to the 10th floor and felt uneasy about the 10th floor and went to Flamingo and didn't feel, you know, particularly great about Flamingo. And he said of Flamingo, again, it's like he went there and it was cliquish. There were 10 different cliques. Each clique had 20 to 30 people, and it remained a very select group of people. And what Alan told me is that, you know, and again, I quote, it's like the economy was very depressed, and there were many unemployed gay people who couldn't afford to go out partying with these people on a Saturday night. They needed an alternative. And so his idea was to create what he describes as a completely safe and non-elitist environment for a large group of people. He says people, he does really mean gay men. And of those gay men, it's kind of mainly white white gay men. But there's definitely at the 12 West, there was a far wider range of kind of class backgrounds. And you could also sort of, I think we should also settle, you know, body types. You know, if you were, you know, the thing about the flamingo is it did become this kind of, you know, this, it was a lot about kind of how beautiful you were. And how toned your body was. And there was a huge emphasis on that. And, you know, and one of the criticisms of the scene is how it, you know, could become somewhat narcissistic. You know, this everyone trying to indeed become a kind of, you know, become the imitation of a kind of Greek, you know, Greek god almost. Whereas the 12th floor, 12 West, sorry, 12th floor, we're getting a bit mixed up here, aren't we? Well, maybe it's just me. The 12th West was much more kind of about, you know, it was non-attitudinal. It didn't matter how you looked, etc. You know, it was you were welcome. So there was a loft spirit, basically, for a more or less white gay scene. But there would have been some women there. There certainly would have been more dancers of colour at 12 West. I'm still sure that if you went in there, it would have been at least 90, if not 95% white. But it was definitely a lot more open socially, and it was a lot more relaxed. And it's worth mentioning it was on the West Side Highway, located on West Street. This is where it got its name from. Basically, at the foot of the abandoned piers on the Hudson River, which was a notorious cruising space. And also where, you know, I think maybe beginning around this time, certainly accelerating as the decade went on and went into the night, and we get into the 1980s. But a lot of the drag houses, the ballroom houses that would prepare for the balls, would also hang out there. So there was generally as a big hangout space, and it was more mixed and it was more open, and that was where 12 West happened. It opened in March 1975, and it was a big success. Tom Savarese, who actually I think passed away a month or two ago, he did become a significant DJ. He won the bill. I've never cared about this too much. Maybe that's not good of me. He won Tom Savarese. I'm sure won Billboard DJ of the Year a few years, for at least a couple of years, at least twice. He was, you know, a popular, successful, very competent DJ who went on to become a fairly successful, or even maybe more than fairly successful, maybe very successful remixer. I need to check his remix discography a bit, but he was the main DJ. I mean, just to bring in a bit of music, we can play a track that I know that Tom Savarese played, because he listed it in his, you know, in the Vincelletti record files column, and this is Dionne Warwick, Take It From Me. So yeah, I mean, just to give a little bit more on 12 West, and to quote Alan Harris a little bit, Alan told me, you found people who were overweight, people who were short, people who weren't muscular, people who danced by themselves, people who just strolled around the dance floor, and people who were older. There were women as well, including a group from the New York Ballet, although I wouldn't say there was an overabundance of women, because it wasn't really designed for them. The crowd was white, Latino, and Asian, although the Asian community wasn't as large back then. Plus, there was definitely a black element. So we have this emergence of, you know, basically a party definitely created for gay men, and most of them being white gay men, that nevertheless tried to kind of be truer, if you like, or just embrace more explicitly, you know, what David was doing at the Loft.
Well, I think that sort of wraps it up for the emergence of that club scene. But we thought we should finish out the episode just quite briefly talking about the fact that there were emergent forms. I'm using that word emergent a lot today, so sue me. There were emergent forms of queer culture at the same time, also coming out of New York partly. Or actually, no, not from New York. These guys weren't in New York. Well, I'll explain why I said New York. Which were not really part of, they're not connected to disco, they're not connected to loft, they're not really connected to the legacy of the 60s counterculture. So you can already point to the scene that had existed around the Factory and Andy Warhol and the Velvet Underground, the way they would influence bands who would have been playing at the same time. As we've been talking about, bands like proto-punk bands like the New York Dolls. And what they all have in common is what's sometimes described as this sort of trash aesthetic, this fascination with the idea of a sort of throwaway culture, and this fascination with the cultural detritus, the despised elements of popular culture, the B movies, the fat people, the trashy pop rather than high-minded soul or rock. And probably one of the purest expressions of this aesthetic to emerge at this time is the group around John Waters, who was a filmmaker, who had this sort of troupe of performers and friends with whom he would make films. He was based in Baltimore at the time, but very much was extending and playing with that Andy Warhol aesthetic. And Waters's famous first film comes out in 1972. Same year the 10th Floor is launched. And it is called Pink Flamingos for fairly obscure reasons. You know, the flamingo is a sort of symbol of high camp. But it's a crazy film. It's the first film, I think, featuring Divine, this obese, not meaning that as an insult, just a description. Maybe I should think of a different...
Very large,
physically very large drag queen, who would eventually, in the early 80s, release some sort of high-energy dance records, at least one I know of, and would become a queer icon. It's a very weird film featuring, and I think it's the plot features a baby smuggling ring or something. It's not clear exactly when it's set, but the music is all from the early 60s, and this theme that runs through Waters' films, through to his big commercially successful film, Hairspray, which is from the 80s, I think, one of the themes that runs through is this fascination with the early 60s and the sort of commercial culture of the early 60s. And Waters would always say that he and his collaborators were punks avant la lettre, because they liked, he would say about the psychedelic hippie counterculture, we liked the drugs, but we hated all that love crap. And this was a very different form of queer culture, self-consciously queer, very, very, very self-consciously queer culture, which really owed more to Warhol's sort of fascination with commercial culture and with forms of culture which make absolutely no aspiration whatsoever to any sort of high-mindedness. And it's sort of fascinating. It's not an accident that I think Waters has his peak moment of cultural presence really at the end of the 80s, because he comes to be seen as someone who had sort of anticipated postmodernism in certain ways and also anticipated the emergence of queer rather than gay.
Yeah, exactly.
As a terminological concept that in a sense none of the people we've been talking about in the past few episodes would have used the word queer to talk about themselves. They probably would have used the term gay, and gay would have been understood as in some sense allied to this moment of the liberation movements and the counterculture, etc. And queer, depending who you ask, once people start to adopt that term queer in the second half of the 80s, depending who you're asking, queer might see itself as a radicalization of some of those tendencies in the way that some punks saw themselves as radicalizing the counterculture, or it might be seen as a reaction against them and as a general rejection of them, either seeing them as tediously moralistic and hypocritical, or just seeing them as, you know, uninteresting, fundamentally unattractive. I mean, Waters isn't like a right-wing libertarian. I think his politics have always been pretty left-wing, but it's a very, very different aesthetic. So it's worth stressing that the bit of emergent gay queer culture that we've been talking about for four episodes now is not the only one that's emerging at that time. And what is sort of fascinating in a way, actually, is that Waters doesn't seem to have had any interest in, for example, the Velvet Underground or David Bowie or the Grateful or the New York Dolls or any of that stuff. He doesn't really seem to have been interested in all that stuff in a way that the later remembering by queer historians and filmmakers of that moment might have led you to expect. What he's fascinated with is the completely self-consciously commercial and completely unpretentious bubblegum pop of the early 60s. And I thought we could close out with a track, one of the tracks from the film, which, just because we're talking about the trash aesthetic, is sort of fascinating. It is a surf pop, surf rock track by a group calling themselves the Trash Men. And it is Surfing Bird.
Oh, well, everybody's heard about the bird. Bird. The bird's a winner. Well, the bird. The bird is a winner. Well, the bird. Well, the bird is a winner. Well, the bird. The bird's a winner. Well, the bird. Well, the bird is a winner. Well, the bird. The bird's a winner. Well, the bird. The bird's a winner. Well, the bird. Well, the bird is a winner. Well, the bird. The bird's a winner. Well, don't you know about the bird? Well, everybody knows that the bird is a winner.
So, a sort of interesting reminder there. I mean, I think Waters' fascination with the early 60s has to be seen in some sense as continuous with his rejection of hippie culture and his sense that in some sense, the liberalization that's going on across the culture in the first half of the 60s doesn't go in exactly the right direction when it becomes associated with the particular forms of political and social radicalism of the late 60s and early 70s. But I'm not sure. I don't think Waters himself would agree with that, actually. I think Waters would see his own politics as pretty radical. It would probably be more the case that what he would see himself as wanting to have distanced himself from was those things coming out of the counterculture that by the early 70s are becoming quite accessible, they're becoming quite comfortable, they're becoming easily commodifiable. And in a way, I think his sort of celebration of this trash aesthetic is about trying to get away from the kinds of cultural hierarchies which are quickly reproducing themselves at places like the 10th floor. It's partly that, I think that's what's really driving it.
It's a really good account of John Waters and Divine and the trash aesthetic and queerness as well. I think it's just I agree. And I think that maybe our use of the term queer is, you know, shifts in, you know, maybe we use it in different ways at different points to refer to different things. But yeah, you're right. What's interesting about this aesthetic, I think, and it's an important part of queerness, as probably both of us also understand it generally, is it's also about, you know, and it was a very important part of it, you know, its self-understanding as a you know, mode of analysis and a way of living and a political critique, is that it's disruptive, it's not conformist. And that's what's going on in this film. Everything, you know, there's this kind of, I mean, you did mention this, but to kind of reiterate a little bit, there's this, you know, there's a real focus on the abject. The things don't want to talk about, the piss and the shit and the murders and the rape.
Yes, there's poo and there's violent sex and there's kind of comedically, I mean, not in a sort of titillating way. Like the whole vibe is it's not titillating. It's just everything is comedically, absurdly disgusting.
Yeah. So there's this, so that's part of what queerness is about as well. And I know that, you know, this comes through more clearly maybe by the early 1980s, but you do have this kind of what was perceived to be, it helps us understand what's going on in the 70s, of course. There's this idea that a sort of a gay clone type emerges who is white, who is gay, who lives in the West Village and who dons the uniform that we've been describing that was worn at the 10th floor and then Flamingo, the jeans, the t-shirt, the flight jacket, the this, that, the type of boots. And, it, you know, it got to the point where this was also the part of the tribal energy at places like Flamingo, is that you could almost everyone did kind of look like each other. And of course with Divine, it's the complete opposite. It's all about looking like no one else. And this disruptiveness, which is also supposed to be around the disruptiveness of, you know, how you dress, how you conduct yourself, and also your sexuality. So these are some interesting tensions that kind of, you know, clarify, you know, as you have explained around this point, I think. But, you know, definitely, we can see how one scene can be seen to be increasingly conformist effectively, and that on that level, being, you know, gay, you could say, is not about disruption per se. It becomes about kind of, you know, joining into a kind of a group which has a kind of, you know, very specific way of kind of conducting itself. and is trying to be internally coherent. I mean, interestingly, Divine, I mean, I don't know if this is going to be a good final point or not, but Divine did go to the loft, I think quite regularly. And, you know, a little quote I have from David that reflects on this a little bit, which is just about the party, really. But David, you know, he said it wasn't a black party or a gay party. There'd be a mixture of people. And then David said, Divine used to go. Now, how do you categorize her? And this is the point, you know, it's, you know, queerness has been, you know, defying easy categorization. Interestingly, I mean, I think this just shows there's a mobility in the way that people live and move around cities and, you know, conduct their lives by doing more than just one thing the whole time. Divine also, I don't know if Divine was a regular at Flamingo, but I do remember having a photo from Flamingo, which may have been a slightly later moment. It could be 1977 or 78, but I can't remember. I should check. But Divine goes to Flamingo. Andy Warhol is there as well, actually, interestingly, given the thematic that we're on here. And there's a pecs contest at Flamingo. You know, basically guys, you know, who's got the most, who's been going to the gym and has the best pecs. And both Andy Warhol and Divine, who are in this photo, are judges at this Flamingo pecs contest. So make of that what you will.
Wow. Okay. I think we have to leave it there. Well, thanks for listening. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. As usual, if you've got the means to chuck us a few quid on Patreon, please do. If you don't, no worries. If you've got the time, please do leave us a 5-star rating on whatever podcast app you like, or even take the time to write a couple of lines of review if you possibly can. And just tell your friends about the podcast, share it on social media, because it all really helps to keep building up the audience and help support the work. And whatever you do, or even if you do nothing, thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks very much. Bye bye.